Hi, I'm Goldie Sayers, Olympic medalist, and welcome to another episode of the EIS Insider, the podcast from the English Institute of Sport that lifts the lid on the science behind peak performance. There's a famous saying that sport is 10% physical and 90% mental, but how much time do we really spend on the mental side of our game? And can the head really rule the heart? In this episode, we'll find out how psychology can help us all optimise our performance, whether we're on the field of play or not, and discover what lessons sport can teach us to take into our everyday lives. And joining me to help harness the power of my brain in this episode is Kate Hayes, Head of Performance Psychology at the EIS. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Goldie.
I think when we mention psychology, some people tend to have this view that it's lying on a couch talking about your childhood, perhaps. So what is psychology in sport, in your opinion, Kate?
It's interesting, isn't it? I think there's been many different perceptions of sports psychology over the years, and it's certainly changed in the last two decades that I've been working as a performance psychologist. I remember when I first started out, you were met with either some slight trepidation about exactly as you've described, are you just going to be trying to get into my head? Or it was quite often seen as a reactive service that was there to solve problems. And I think there has been a definite shift in the perception of the discipline, that psychology is now seen very much as a proactive performance enhancement service. And yes, there will always be instances where athletes might be trying to work through a particular problem or problem solve something or are working through some challenges, and that might require some assistance from a performance psychologist. But probably 80% of the work that we do is proactive. And it's about looking at current reality and looking at where people want to get to and helping to close that gap as quickly as possible.
And in your role, have you just been working with athletes, or is that primarily with coaches as well, or a bit of both?
A lot of the applied work that I do now is in team sports. And so a lot of the work that I do in the sports that I work with is working very collaboratively and synonymously with the coaching teams to identify what are the nuances of that sport, what is actually required from a psychological perspective, and how can we facilitate training sessions that drive the development of those characteristics.
And in a team sport, what sort of characteristics are most prevalent, would you say, that are most important for a performance psychology?
I mean, I get asked this all the time, and what are some of the psychological characteristics that are important? I think that there are some that are just important regardless in any sport. And essentially, in order to perform at your best, you need to be able to focus on the right thing at the right time and not get distracted from it. And if we're going to go to real simplicity for a minute, that's essentially what it is. So part of that is understanding, well, what is the right thing to think about at this moment in time? And then the secondary piece is, how do I stop myself from being distracted from that? So focus, the ability to kind of bounce back from errors. There's no such thing as a perfect performance. And so at some point in a rugby game or a football game or in any other athletic performance, mistakes are going to be made. So there's the ability to be able to just continually go back to the correct focus of attention that's going to enable you to be successful.
Okay, so if somebody has just cocked up on the field of play and made a mistake, as we all have, or in my case, if I've had an awful throw, how would you as a sports psychologist bring somebody's focus back to what they need to do? Are there any techniques or tips that we could all use in everyday life that help with that?
For me as a sports psychologist, some of the time you're spending on helping athletes prepare, and some of the time you're helping them develop strategies to put into play in the moment. And for me, practicing those things are absolutely fundamental. So what if that's part of your contingency planning? What if you do make a mistake? What if you do miss the shot? What if being able to have the opportunity to practice some of those things in advance, whether that's going through that in a conversation, or better still, whether it's putting that into practice in a training environment. But different people respond to things in different ways. Some athletes are able to very quickly compartmentalize and put things to bed. Others haven't. And so how athletes approach that will be quite individualistic. Does there need to be some kind of fast, hot debrief to make sense of it, to be able to move on? Is it trigger words? Is it visualization? Is it utilizing support of somebody else on the field of play, etc.? Everybody will respond to those situations differently. So it's A, really important to understand how an individual will respond, and B, then how do you create scenarios to give them the opportunity to practice?
So we sort of need to practice messing up a bit as well.
100%. 100%. Yeah. And, you know, I say that flippantly, but I absolutely mean it. Creating opportunities where you gradually increase challenge and reduce support and give people opportunities to have to be able to make mistakes and problem solve is absolutely fundamental.
So I guess you've probably been asked this question a million times, especially post European Championship football and dreaded penalties. So what would you do in that scenario about getting better at taking penalties, performing under that amount of pressure and potentially making mistakes? So how would you get an England team kind of better at taking penalties and dealing with the consequences of that?
The reality of the situation is you can't recreate a penalty shootout in training sessions. You can't. Yeah. So what can you do? I think there's probably two ways of approaching this. You have to be able to create a similar psychological and physiological response in the athlete as you can. Now, you won't be able to do that by creating a penalty shootout, so you have to do something else. And that's when you get into looking at constraints-based coaching versus pressure training. So all coaches will be well-versed in how do you create constraints within a training session to change the task, to make it more difficult, to make it easier, to try to help people adapt to solving problems. You only get into the realms of pressure training when there is a consequence. Mm-hmm. And so creating scenarios and creating situations in training sessions where there is a consequence will create a feeling of pressure for the individual, and then they have to learn how to execute skill with that same physiological, psychological response. So it's not about creating or trying to recreate match conditions. It's about how do you stimulate an individual so that they are having to execute a skill in the same physiological, psychological state as they would be in a penalty shootout. And that's one way. And the other way is how can you reduce the complexity or the difficulty of the task? How can you potentially take decision-making away when the pressure is on to try to reduce the cognitive load on an individual, etc.? So there would be, for me, that's about what's the philosophy of the manager if we get down to football, and what is their approach? And I'd be looking at how do we instigate a pressure response in those individuals in a training scenario, number one. Number two, is there any way of decreasing the cognitive cost of that task? And if so, how might that be done?
So would one of those ways be just decide where you're going to hit the penalty and go for it and have that pre-planned? Yeah. So you're not having to think about it?
Yeah, potentially. And this is, yeah, speaking from a novice of football, but essentially, yeah, how do you, or how do you practice a range of shots, and then the manager decide on which one is taken? Or do you know what I mean? How do you share cognitive load, essentially?
So I mentioned at the top there that, you know, elite sport is or can be seen as 10% physical, 90% mental. Would you agree with that? Can people who are better at psychology do better if they've come into a competition having not trained as much as somebody else?
Can a psychology replace physical preparation? No. It would be the simple answer of that. Can you improve your performance through having appropriate psychological skills? 100%. My PhD looked at the role of confidence in world-class sport performance, for example, and one of the most consistent findings in the sports psychology literature is a direct correlation between high levels of confidence and high levels of sporting performance. So where does confidence come from? Well, we know that our world-class athletes derive confidence from mental and physical and holistic preparation. So doing the physical work, doing the strength and conditioning, doing the technical work, getting their nutrition right, doing their performance analysis, doing their psychological preparation. And it's a combination of those things that can feed into confidence. And then there are times where, you know, people are having a bad day in the office or training isn't going quite as well. Can you counteract some of that stuff with your psychological approach? Yes, of course. But essentially what we're trying to do is ensure that our athletes get to the start line best prepared. And that is a combination of things from psychology through to technical, tactical, physical training, through lifestyle factors, etc. your best opportunity is being able to tick all of those boxes.
So if we're talking about confidence, how could you improve somebody's confidence in a particular area of their life, say away from sport? Are there any tips or tricks that you tend to use with athletes that you could apply to somebody in everyday life?
Yeah, and I think it's going to sound like a really simple answer to that question, but I think one of the key things is just being really proactive about it and actually work to enhancing your confidence. Confidence is a multifaceted characteristic. So you can be confident in one thing and not confident in something else, and you derive confidence from lots of different places. So if we start with a sporting example to begin with, if you base your confidence entirely from winning and then you have a poor performance, that can very quickly debilitate your confidence. So when we're trying to help athletes develop robust confidence, we're trying to encourage them to develop it from multiple sources. So how do athletes plan for training? How do they review their training sessions? How do they mark their improvement and their performance in relation to their goals? Where do they go for feedback? Whose opinion do they require? How do they keep a note of some of the things that they're doing well? And I kind of see confidence as it's almost like a bank account. You pay in and you pay in and you pay in. So then when you need to, there's a lot in there to withdraw from. And essentially, like, the 4-year preparation to Olympic Games is you're paying into a bank account for 4 years so that on the Olympic day you can withdraw all of that evidence base in order to enable you to perform. And essentially that's what confidence is. Confidence is a set of evidence-based beliefs. It's a knowledge that you are able to do something because you have some evidence for that. So then if we look at life outside of sport, it's exactly the same thing. If you want to become confident at public speaking, for example, well, then how do you go about doing that? You have to develop the skill sets to be able to do that. You have to be prepared to put yourself into environments to build up confidence to speak in front of other people. You need to, if you're the sort of person that relies on external feedback, then there needs to be somebody in place that you can trust, that you can talk to about how you're progressing, etc. But these things don't just happen. It's taking a proactive and definite move forward to help yourself develop and grow.
So if we're talking about confidence and having a lot of confidence, can this be seen as a lack of nerves?
No, I don't think it can. And I think that's one of the great myths of psychology, that those athletes that are confident skip out onto the track with a big smile on their face and go. And that's not the reality of it. The nerves are a heightened arousal state that mean that you're ready to do something and that you feel under pressure. And you feel under pressure because what you're about to do is important to you. It's very, very rare that athletes don't experience that. They might describe it in different ways. One athlete might describe it as nerves versus another who might describe it as excitement, for example. But confidence isn't about eradicating that. Confidence is being able to step out onto the field of play, knowing what your job is and knowing that you are capable of executing your job regardless of context, because you've practiced it and you have an evidence base for your ability to be able to do that. That's very different to just thinking positively or not being nervous. I would imagine it is very, very rare that any athlete that lines up for the Olympics in any sport doesn't feel some level of arousal.
No, I can definitely contest to that. when can nerves become a problem, though? Presumably you've worked with some athletes who've got horrendously nervous, and I've certainly seen, you know, Olympic champions who, you know, you worry about mm-hmm. them actually performing, they're that nervous. So as you say, yeah, you need that level of arousal. But when do they become a problem?
And I think that's it. I think it's exactly as you said there, Goldie. I think nerves become a problem when they interfere with people's ability to execute their role. So if the nerves that are being experienced are having a detrimental impact on performance, then that's at the point where you would want to help the athletes develop some strategies to minimize that, because they form a distraction. It's that, are you being distracted by the what if thinking or by the arousal, or are you overcooked, undercooked, etc. Essentially, we want to try to help people to find themselves in the position where they're best prepared to in order to perform. And for some people, that is a highly aroused state, and for others, less so. But the fundamental question is how you're feeling prior to racing having a detrimental impact on your performance? And is it something that you would like to change, work, or reduce maximize, etc. And that's kind of where you're governed by, really.
And what would you do with an athlete? What kind of strategies would you use with them that might be in your toolbox to help with nerves?
I mean, again, it's very individual, but there's lots of things that you can do, from just having appropriate focus of attention around goals, for having pre-performance routines through mental rehearsal, utilizing visualization, relaxation techniques, breathing techniques, utilizing somebody else's frontal lobe and being able to have a conversation with somebody that isn't in a state of anxiety. There's lots of different things, distraction. You know, I've known of athletes to play rounds of Pass the Pigs in between rounds of the competition, anything to take them out of that moment in time, to distract themselves so that they're not creating fatigue, to then be able to come back in and switch on.
What's Pass the Pigs, Kate?
Have you ever played Pass the Pigs? You need to have a look at
it. No, I
do not. They do a great version of it now. It's essentially two little rubber pigs that you throw, and dependent upon how they land depends upon the points that you get. There's no real thought involved in this game, but it's just something that I know of an athlete that I'm pretty good friends with that utilised it to pass the time.
Amazing. Okay.
There is a whole range of different techniques, and what works for one person won't necessarily work for somebody else. So it's about, how do you help an athlete understand when they're at their best, what they're thinking, feeling at those moments in time, how that influences their behaviour and how they show up, how they move from training into the competition environment, what are the similarities, what are the differences. And essentially it's a process over a period of time where you're helping people to understand themselves, to understand what works for them, to understand what doesn't, and then to be able to develop approaches and routines and around their performance that actually help.
You mentioned visualization there. How effective a tool can that be? It's seen, I think, with a lot of people to be this mythical thing that you can either do or you can't, and people struggle quite a lot with it. So how effective is it in sport?
I think it's really interesting, isn't it? Like, some athletes really love it and some athletes don't, and some people do naturally find it easier than others. The thing for me is everybody can do it. And you only need to ask somebody to describe how they get home from school or from work to see that everybody can do it. Some people find it easier than others. And I also think that there is an element of the kind of sport, the sport that you're involved in. So when I worked in diving, we did a lot of visualization work with the athletes. But diving is a closed skill sport. It's not influenced by context, by environment, by other people, by decisions that have to be made. It's about your ability to get up there and execute a closed skill. And so the athletes got a lot of confidence from being able to mentally rehearse and visualize that, particularly at times where they maybe weren't able to get into the pool for a range of different reasons. And the other thing that the divers used to find visualization quite helpful for was just to create some familiarity around the competition environment that they were about to go into. So if they were competing in a pool that they hadn't competed in before, being able to get hold of photographs, videos, starting to put together a picture of where they might be on poolside, where they would go to the coach to get feedback from, where they would start to implement their pre-performance routine. It just reduced any feelings of anxiety from not being familiar with the competition environment. So I think it has lots of different purposes. Some athletes use it all the time routinely, some athletes less so, but can it be effective? Absolutely, yes.
So you've talked about obviously working a lot in GB diving, but also within rugby as well at Harlequins. Were there differences in what the athletes came to you seeking help with?
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating in terms of sports on either end of a continuum or spectrum. I'd say probably rugby and high board diving are about as opposite as they could get. I mean, I came from sport diving where essentially in competition they have to be able to be completely in control of their physiology, because, and again, this is where pressure training becomes so important. If you're a diver and you're training without pressure and then you move into a competition environment where you're under pressure, you feel different. So even if you aren't getting any greater height out of the board, you sometimes feel that you are. And the divers are very good at fixing things. So if they feel that they're a bit off or something's awry in the air, they can actually make fixes to that to change it, which is why in a diving competition, you quite often see divers flying over or under because they're just executing a skill in a different, in different constraints or in a different environment than they used to train in. So I went from a sport where it's all about how do you maintain control, how do you stay neutral, how are you able to execute that close skill into a sport that is highly charged and emotive. And I mean, looking around the dressing room prior to a rugby match, how many of those are in a very neutral, controlled state? It is just completely different. But the demands of the sport are completely different too. Diving is about executing close skills that are rehearsed over and over again with very little environmental constraints. Rugby is a decision-making sport where you are having to react and respond to stimuli all of the time. So you're having to be able to, yeah, you learn your patterns of play and you have an understanding about how you're going to approach the game, but essentially you're playing what you see. So you're having to be able to respond, to think quickly, to make decisions. And there is a highly dynamic nature to that, where what you do is influenced by what the next person does and vice versa. So the preparation for competition in those two sports couldn't be any more different.
And I'd imagine that's where arousal comes into it quite a lot. You know, rugby, I'd imagine you have to be fairly up for a game. And obviously you mentioned they're diving, they have to be very controlled. How do you know when you're kind of over or under aroused?
I think athletes are a very good judge of that. And I'll ask, if I may, that question back to you. Were you aware when you were over or under aroused?
Most of the time, I think, yeah, it does have a dependency on how important the competition is. I think it's also experience. I used to find the whole feeling of lethargy quite interesting as a sort of somatic kind of anxiety thing, where you might have a big competition and feel really lethargic, but actually you learn through experience that that's your body getting you ready for something big. But sports psychology wasn't quite so prevalent at the start of my career, so I wish I'd kind of known that a bit earlier on. So you do, but I think you can still make mistakes as you get, you know, more experienced. It's and I think it, you know, over or under arousal can show up in different ways, I guess, as well.
Absolutely. And I think what you've just said there is so important, because such a large part of the work that we do as psychologists is education. It's just helping athletes understand what's normal and why they're experiencing some of the things that they're experiencing. And even just that can have a huge impact. Why am I yawning before I'm about to compete? Well, actually, sometimes that happens. Yeah. Versus, you know, sweaty palms, racing heart. It's, people don't necessarily always respond in the way that they think that they're going to or think that they would expect to. And just being able to educate people around that this is what's going on and this is why it's going on and this is your body responding in the way that as human beings we were designed to respond. So this is all usual. This is all normal. The likelihood is that you'll feel this way every single time that you compete, and that's okay.
And in terms of psychology, we hear a lot about mind games, especially in team sports more prevalently. But obviously there's a lot that goes on in dressing rooms or waiting areas in individual sports as well. Is it possible to psych an opponent out, or should we not be getting involved in that at all? And how do we resist it, I guess, if somebody is trying to psych us out when we perform?
I mean, for me, as a performance psychologist, I don't think the aim should ever be to psych somebody out. I think your aim should be to do the things that you need to do that are going to put you into the most appropriate mindset to be able to do your job. And if, as a result of that, your opposition gets psyched out, then so be it. But the purpose should be around what do we need to do to ensure that we're best able to get ourselves into the place that we need to be in to compete and to get our best game out onto the park.
And I guess when we're talking about the best place to be, we hear a lot about getting into the zone in sport. So what does that mean in psychological terms, and how do we get there?
For me, being in the zone is being able to flex and adapt and respond to what's in front of you without being distracted by internal or external noise. And I guess, you know, again, in its most simplistic terms, what's mental toughness? Ability to focus on the right thing at the right time. And being in the zone is being able to play and to compete with composure without becoming distracted by internal and external noise. how do people get into the zone? I think that is different for everybody. And I think it is learning through trial and error and through experience and through facilitated practice and conversations around what are some of the things that feed into you, your successes, and what are some of the things that you found to be debilitating. And it's a cyclical process over time where people learn what works and what doesn't. And you can't always force it. The reality of the situation is, you know, more often than not, one day you're going to have to compete when you're not feeling that great. And you may have had food poisoning the night before, or you know, there's a whole range of things that can happen. It's not always perfect. Your preparation isn't always perfect. But having enough of an evidence base of being able to perform and to pull it out of the bag when you need to is really important.
And you mentioned mental toughness there about being able to make the right decision at the right time. So I think a lot of people think of mental toughness as being able to do a really hardcore session, and coaches think that they're going to build mental toughness in their athletes if they absolutely kind of nail them in training. So you'd say that's absolutely not the case.
Well, I think it's that, again, for me, that's around how do you develop resilience? How do you develop the ability to push when you're hurting? Like there's lots of different things that you could argue are all components of mental toughness, and what you choose to focus your time and attention depends a lot on your coaching philosophy, on the athlete that you've got in front of you, and what the demands of the sport and the task are. The question always is, you know, if you're a diver, or if you're a 100 meter runner, or if you're a javelin thrower, or if you're a number 10, what is your role? What do you need to be able to do under pressure? And therefore, what are some of the things that we could have put in place to give us the best opportunity for practicing that? And, you know, what are the sports where you have to be able to really go through the pain barrier? What are the sports that are going to demand a high level of physical work versus a high decision-making component versus high levels of cognitive cost? All sports are different, and the requirements of them are different. So for me, mental toughness is about how do we ensure that we are creating environments that enable people to develop and grow in a multitude of different areas so that they're best prepared to execute their skills when it counts.
And you talked about lots of different sports there, and obviously there's lots of different sports in the Olympic Games, and you worked very heavily with the team out in Tokyo this summer at the Olympic Games. I guess in the run-up to Tokyo, you were dealing a lot with athletes and their kind of rising levels of uncertainty around the Games. How do you work with athletes around uncertainty?
Yeah, the last 18 months, I mean, what a crazy time. None of us were prepared for that or I think ready for it. But we've learned so much, I think, not only as a psychology team, but as a system over the last 18 months. And to take you on a bit of a journey through that, to hopefully eventually answer your question, we obviously went into lockdown. And the first questions that we were asking as a team is, how do we support people well through this? Like, how do we ensure that we are doing the right thing for our athletes and our staff, and we are providing the best levels of support that we can? And where can we go to find out more? And there's lots of examples of some really good, you know, space adventures or nautical voyages, or where people have been in periods of isolation. But all of those examples are scenarios where people have been incredibly well prepared over a period of time and have made a choice. And what we were dealing with was a scenario where people had no choice and were told, you now need to stay at home and you're not able to do the things that you would ordinarily be doing. So we actually went, the psychology team at the IIS went to some research that had been published by the Red Cross around hostages and how they are supported in their reintegration back into society. And as a result of that, we did a big piece of work around how you debrief the lockdown process and how you help people find higher purpose and look for meaning and identify skills and strategies that they may have developed that they could utilize moving forward, etc. And I think part of what happened over the last 18 months was that lots of staff and athletes did exactly that. They reconnected or connected with things that they maybe hadn't had the opportunity to do for a while. And there were lots of conversations around higher purpose and around people's meaning and why they did what they did and what they wanted to do and how that might feed into their future plans, etc. And I think a lot of that stuff helped with some of the uncertainty around, will the games happen, won't they happen, will I be selected, won't I be selected, will those decisions stand or not. The reality of the situation was we were dealing with a huge amount of uncertainty from that point right the way through, and even during the games. It never went away. So people were having to be really flexible and adaptable. And we had some relatively strong messaging right from the beginning. It was really simple but consistent around, don't avoid uncertainty. If we want people to deal with this well, we have to be able to give them the platform to be able to voice their concerns. And people need to feel that they are being accepted, listened to, that stuff is being normalized. If we don't allow people the platform, then it will show up anyway, and potentially in a less helpful way. So we had clear messaging around, you know, being able to voice concerns, to have those concerns listened to try to find controllables within a completely uncontrollable landscape, and having realistic conversations with people around what may or may not happen, and then what the consequences of some of those things might be.
And presumably you've worked with, you know, probably Olympic champions, Olympic medalists. What do Olympic champions do psychologically that perhaps their competition doesn't? And are there any common traits in the psyche of champions compared to us mere mortals?
The athletes that I work with that have won at that level, whether it's Olympics, World Championships or professional equivalent, have had absolute clarity on what they needed to do and absolute belief in their ability to be able to do that, because they had demonstrated that across multiple contexts under multiple constraints. And whether that's a difference between being a champion or not, I don't know. But that's one thing that all of them had. And you may argue that everybody that gets to Olympic Games is able to do that. But certainly the teams, individuals that I've worked with that have won at that level would absolutely have that clarity on what it is that they need to do, what their focus of attention needs to be. They're just best prepared to be able to execute their role on the day and know that they can do that regardless of consequences, because they've put themselves under so many different contextual constraints that have enabled them to problem solve and be able to. So high levels of confidence in being able to execute their game plan based upon really solid evidence.
So in that, would you say that kind of winning creates more winning?
I think learning how to win creates more winning. And that doesn't mean that the doubt isn't going to be there. It doesn't mean that they're not going to have the what if thoughts. It doesn't mean that they're not going to throw up prior to going out onto the pitch. It doesn't mean that they're going to have a sleepless night. It just means that they know that they can do all of those things and still compete.
And anybody listening to this who perhaps isn't a sports person, who wouldn't mind the odd quick fix on their psychology, what are your kind of go-to exercises that somebody listening to this could take away and perhaps work on to improve their psychology or confidence or resilience or whatever it might be? Are there any tools that you like to use?
I mean, there's so much, but for me, the most important thing is really good objective self-reflection. Because quite often, and you'll see this with the kids, they'll come running up, oh, did you see that? Did you see what I did there today? Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, great. Why do you think that was? And you get this like blank, what? And it's finding ways of helping them understand what it was that led them to be able to do that one day that may actually enable them to recreate it the next. Getting into habits of what was I trying to do today, and was I successful? And if I was, why is that? And how can I test that hypothesis tomorrow? And if I wasn't, why was that? And how might I make changes to what I do tomorrow to enable me to be successful? It's that learning of how do we recreate the good and eliminate the bad? How do we learn what works for us and what doesn't? And there's lots of different things. There's lots of different psychological strategies from, you know, as we've talked lots about, anxiety management techniques, breathing techniques, visualization techniques. There's lots of different things. But the crux of it, right at the bottom for me, is do you have really good process of self-reflection, and do you understand why you behave in a certain way in one context and completely differently in another, and what it is, what happens to your cognitions, to your emotions, to your behaviours, and how does that show up? And that is that process of understanding and self-reflection, I think, that's absolutely critical.
So sort of start with self-awareness and then everything else can be layered.
That was a much simpler way of articulating that, wasn't it?
Yeah. I had a good teacher.
Start with the self-awareness first. Yeah.
Make it sound easy, and it absolutely is. So I'm off to reflect on my performance here, Kate. Thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thanks ever so much. Thank you.
So far this series, we've talked about how to eat like a champion, how to train like a champion, and now how to think like a champion. If you've missed any of our previous episodes, they're all available for free wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to continue the conversation about anything we've discussed, you can get in touch with us on social media at EIS2Win. And don't forget to check out our website and YouTube channel for more great content from the English Institute of Sport. Coming up next time on the EIS Insider, we'll be unlocking the secrets of sleep. I can't wait for that one. That's on the way in the next episode of the EIS Insider. Speak to you then.